Good morning. On today's programme, the soaring cost of fuel in Kenya and how the rich and famous on the French Riviera have been raising funds for an Irish sailing boat. But first to Western Canada, where an Indigenous community that was the epicentre of a stabbing rampage earlier this month has said, "We are broken but not defeated." 11 people died and 18 were wounded in the knife attacks at the James Smith Cree Nation in north-central Saskatchewan. The main suspect was apprehended after an intense four-day manhunt, but died shortly after his arrest while in police custody. Police say the motive behind the attacks might never be known, and the investigation could take months. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, the tragedy has raised questions about the parole system in Saskatchewan and what many describe as a life of despair on reserves, where alcohol and drugs and violence are often prevalent.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police were called to the reserve early on a Sunday morning after multiple reports of stabbings. The James Smith Cree Nation was stunned by the attacks that left 10 people dead and one in the neighboring town of Weldon. Within an hour, police were looking for two suspects, brothers Miles and Damien Sanderson, both in their early 30s, and a stolen black SUV. A day later, the body of Damien Sanderson was found in a grassy area on the reserve. Police say his wounds were not self-inflicted. It's believed that some of the victims of the attacks were targeted, while others may have been attacked randomly. Assistant RCMP Commissioner in charge of the force in Saskatchewan, Rhonda Blackmore, said, "It is horrific what occurred in our province today." Police were investigating 13 separate crime scenes on the reserve and at Weldon. 4 days later, police received several reports of the prime suspect, Miles Sanderson, in a stolen white pickup truck northeast of Saskatoon. Police cruisers forced him off the highway, and he was swiftly taken into custody. But police say he was in distress. Paramedics were called, and he was taken to a hospital in Saskatoon, where he was pronounced dead. The 32-year-old Miles Sanderson had a nearly two-decade-long criminal record. He also had a propensity for violence when he was intoxicated, this according to a parole board document. Sanderson himself had told the board that when he regularly used drugs and hard alcohol, it would make him lose his mind and he would get angry. The parole board document said Sanderson's criminal history was very concerning, including the use of violence and weapons. Still, Sanderson received a statutory release from prison in August of last year. The board said it determined that Sanderson would not present an undue risk to society if released. If he stayed sober, his risk would be manageable. He had been serving a sentence of more than 4 years for offenses including assault, assault with a weapon, assaulting a peace officer, and robbery. He had a total of 59 criminal convictions. In one incident in 2018, he had been drinking at home and became angry with people he was with, then stabbed two of them with a fork, then beat a man walking nearby unconscious. His childhood had been marked by violence, neglect, and substance abuse. After failing to contact his parole supervisor earlier this year, a bulletin was issued warning that he was unlawfully at large. Flags at government buildings in the province of Saskatchewan were lowered to half-mast to mourn the victims. The flag on the Peace Tower in Ottawa was also lowered. The tragedy reached across Canada. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said to the victims and their families that all Canadians are there for you, and he pledged federal resources to help in dealing with the crisis. Trudeau also said, "As Canadians, we mourn with everyone affected by this tragic violence." He said he was shocked and devastated by the horrific attacks. Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe said there are no words to adequately describe the pain and loss caused by this senseless violence. Other political and Native leaders from across Canada also offered their condolences. The Federation of Sovereign Indian Nations extended its sympathies to the families, relatives, and communities of the victims whose lives were taken during what it called the senseless acts of violence. Alberta Premier Jason Kenney said the brutality and apparent randomness of the attacks shocked the entire country. In the shattered James Cree First Nation itself, just about every family was affected by the tragedy. Everyone knew or was related to a victim. The grieving and the healing began the day after the arrest and death of Miles Sanderson. Chief Wally Burns said words cannot express the effects of what has happened, adding that many families who lost loved ones need support. In a healing ceremony, Indigenous leaders were joined by the RCMP, as well as some federal cabinet ministers. But there are also questions. A criminology expert at Carleton University in Ottawa, Daryl Davies, said there should have been more warning signs from the parole board. adding that Sanderson was like dynamite, set to go off at any time. He says the situation points to what he believes is a chronic dysfunction in how the government and justice system approach crime prevention, calling the justice system in chaos. He says too much money is spent on police and the correctional system, and not enough on social and economic supports for those who grew up with violence, poverty, and addiction. Federal authorities have said there would be a review of the decision to parole Sanderson and of the board's decision-making process. And some Indigenous lawmakers have said the role of historic and ongoing oppression of Indigenous people in Canada also needs to be acknowledged in the wake of the killings. Other Native leaders say many reserves are grappling with rampant child sex abuse, drug and alcohol abuse, mental health crises, and suicides. In one First Nation in Northern Ontario, almost 100 young people tried to end their lives in a 7-month period. In the wake of the stabbings, Chief Wally Burns of the James Smith community has issued a plea for an end to the violence and for more resources to prevent future tragedies, such as local tribal police and an addiction treatment center. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
To East Africa next, and Kenya, where the cost of fuel has reached record highs. Prices shot up after the newly elected President William Ruto scrapped a fuel subsidies scheme in a move which could boost inflation even further. Despite Kenya being considered one of Africa's most economically stable countries, businesses and households are being squeezed to make ends meet. Amy Nirieda reports now from Nairobi.
Rising fuel prices are no surprise to Irish listeners at this stage, but while blame for the increase in costs in the West is being placed on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there are several other factors at play here in Kenya. Up until last week, the Kenyan government had in place a petroleum development levy to cushion people from volatility in prices. For consumers, it meant an extra 5.4 shilling per litre, less than 5 cent at the pumps, which would then be put into a fund in anticipation of the need of a subsidy when fuel prices skyrocketed. It was also supposed to be ring-fenced for badly needed infrastructure upgrades in the sector. But that's not where it went. Earlier this year, an investigation into the management of the fund found that the National Treasury diverted 2.074 billion Kenyan shillings, or over 17.5 million euro, to other state agencies. One undisclosed private firm received 30 million shillings, or 254,000 euro. The government, led by Uhuru Kenyatta at the time, claimed to owe such companies around 13 billion shillings in total. Since last year, policymakers have grappled with the lack of public funds to fully compensate oil marketers for keeping pump prices unchanged. Announcing the removal of the scheme having just been sworn into office, William Ruto said subsidies have been costly and prone to abuse. Now fuel costs are at a historic high. Petrol has increased by 50 shillings a litre since January. Kenya's Energy and Petroleum Regulatory Authority increased the price of diesel by around 18%, and kerosene, which is used by many for household cooking, has increased by 16%. Irish listeners have been victim to extortionate fuel costs for several months now and can likely relate to the pinch Kenyans are feeling at the pumps. However, the average monthly wage in Kenya ranges between 20,000 and 30,000 shillings. That's less than a tenner a day. Yet they're expected to pay the equivalent of €1.51 a litre for petrol. And while the subsidy scheme was proven to be corrupt, the question still remains as to exactly what the government will put in its place to try and help people. Newly sworn in President Ruto faces the dual tasks of bringing astronomical living costs under control and dealing with the government debt bestowed upon him by his predecessor. In June, public debt ballooned to around €71 billion from just €16 billion when the previous administration took office in 2013. The country is now classified by the International Monetary Fund as being at a high risk of debt distress. For Ruto, just days into his tenure, it was squeaky bum time. He had just removed a costly subsidy which had so far stabilised the price at the pumps in order to tighten the government purse. It was seen as a betrayal to the 7 million people who voted him in after promising to immediately lower the cost of living. He had to act quickly, and he did. The self-proclaimed hustler had promised to reduce food production costs and increase output by subsidising other essential items like fertiliser. This week, the National Treasury released 3.6 billion shillings for subsidised fertiliser in line with his manifesto, effectively halving the cost of a bag. The move will support the cultivation of around 1.4 million acres and tied in nicely with his maiden address at the United Nations General Assembly. The hustler survives a week in office, but the country he has inherited is a scarred one, with households squeezed to the limits and corruption dominating many of the headlines. The abolishment of the fuel subsidy scheme is likely the first of many unpopular decisions that will be made to stabilise a shaky economy. What will be done to raise low morale in Kenyans facing crippling costs remains to be seen. For World Report, this is Amy Nirida in Nairobi, Kenya.
Finally, we go to Monaco, where royalty and the well-heeled gathered this month to raise funds for a new training vessel, which will replace two sunken Irish boats, the Asgard II and the Lord Rank. The new boat, the Grace O'Malley, is about to undergo restoration work in Sweden, but when it's ready, it will train around 1,000 young people a year in all aspects of seafaring. From Monaco, Connor Power reports.
It's a warm September evening at the Yacht Club in Monaco, where a large and well-dressed crowd has gathered for a gala dinner and charity auction. Many are from Ireland, and Prince Albert II is in attendance, guaranteeing maximum impact for this prestigious event. By the evening's end, over €50,000 has been raised on behalf of the Atlantic Youth Trust, an all-Ireland charity based in Dunlera that connects young people with the ocean and adventure. It is chaired by entrepreneur and sailor Enda O'Kinneen, who was also in attendance and whose film Unsinkable Entrepreneur was premiered before the event. In July of this year, the Atlantic Youth Trust took delivery of a tall ship training vessel named the Grace O'Malley, which is to replace both the Asgard II and the Lord Rank. The Asgard II was the Irish Republic's national sail training vessel. Commissioned in 1981, it sank in 2008 off the Breton coast. The Lord Rank, meanwhile, a similar sail training vessel serving Northern Ireland, sank 2 years later after hitting rocks off the Antrim coast. The Atlantic Youth Trust's new vessel will replace both ships, and it had been planned for it to make its maiden voyage to Monaco to coincide with this remarkable high-profile event. As it happened, the decision to sail the Grace O'Malley to the French Riviera was a bit overambitious, given that the vessel had only arrived from Sweden a matter of weeks, and it has been postponed until the ship is properly prepared and fitted out for its intended purpose. Robert Lee Mulcahy of the Atlantic Youth Trust divides his time between Monaco and Dublin. At the moment, he explains, the Grace O'Malley is at St. John Rogerson's Quay in Dublin. It has to go for further restoration work back to Sweden. Robert estimates that the ship will be ready for use as a sail training vessel around March of next year and will be training in the region of 1,000 young people every year. The connections between Irishman Robert and the Monegasque royal family go back a number of years, he says. Prince Albert, of course, has important Irish roots through his late mother, the former actress Grace Kelly. And it's a part of his legacy that the prince clearly holds dear. One of the most remarkable manifestations of this Irish connection is the Princess Grace Irish Library. They're partners of this initiative, and the library is just a short walk from the royal palace. Here, packed into an impressive space, is an astounding collection of over 12,000 books based on material that was passed on to the late princess from her Irish-American parents and which stands as a moving tribute as to how seriously the family took their Irish literary and musical heritage. But the Irish connections along this beautiful stretch of coastline are multiple. William Butler Yeats died in Monton, just short of the Italian border, 10 kilometres away, in January 1939, and was buried in the cemetery in Roquebrune Cap Martin, just down the road, until an Irish naval vessel sailed down here 9 years later to remove the poet's remains for reinterment in Sligo. Here in Roquebrune also, another great Irish artist left her indelible mark. The Villa E1027, the creation of Eileen Gray, is now a treasured possession of the French state coastal conservation body Conservatoire du Littoral and is a monument to the Irish woman's unique blend of ingenuity and creative flair. Back in Monaco, the Irish connection is a living, breathing one. Not only will this fundraising gala dinner and auction continue on an annual basis, the proud connections are there and increasing all the time. One of the star items sold at the charity auction was a piece of artwork by Irish artist Mico D. The painting is of the Grace O'Malley, and it was commissioned by Robert. It sold for over €25,000. The important thing, says Robert, is that it will be put hanging in the Monaco Yacht Club on permanent display. The Atlantic Youth Trust, Robert says, is engaged in active discussions with both Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland government institutions to secure permanent funding for this project, which is so vitally important for our island nation. At the same time, a dynamic series of fundraising events, including a 2,000-seater music concert in Ireland next year, continue in tandem. Meanwhile, at the port of the Principality of Monaco, the representation of Ireland's long-awaited national sail training vessel hangs in splendour, awaiting the inevitable arrival of the real thing to this part of the Riviera with such deep Irish roots. For RTE World Report in the Principality of Monaco, this is Conor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.